Psalm 12, you have here David talking about his enemies. And he gives the impression that really the righteous within Israel, and he counts himself as one of them, are somehow a minority. He complains, verse 2, everyone lies to his neighbour, they speak with flattering lips with a double heart. But, verse 7, you will keep them, Yahweh, you'll preserve them from this generation forever. There's a minority of righteous, and the generation around them, the society, as we might say, around them, are wicked, and God preserves this righteous remnant. Verse 8, the wicked walk on every side. Again, he sees the righteous within Israel as surrounded by the wicked on every side, and that which is vile is exalted among the sons of men. And if you look at the word translated vile, it's very often associated with idolatry. So it would appear that there was idolatry going on in David's time and the time of Saul. And you just look at the names of some of Saul's sons, some of Jonathan's children, and clearly they have the Baal suffix or prefix in them, and quite clearly there was idolatry. And yet he sees himself as the righteous one. Well, in his psalms before the sin with Bathsheba, you read a lot of this, and yet later on you find that he has really done that which he accuses society generally of, and Saul and his crew of doing. He complains here that people lie to their neighbour. They speak with flattering lips to their neighbour, and they've got a double heart. Wait a minute. What did he do to Uriah? He did exactly this. He lied to his neighbour, and Nathan brings this out. There were two men in one city, that is, David and Uriah, in one city, Jerusalem, and he took his neighbour's wife. Bathsheba lived next door to him. He was on the roof of his own house, and he looks, as it were, into her yard, and there he sees Bathsheba washing herself and lusts after her. So he then calls Uriah back from the front, tries to flatter him, and with a double heart, writes a letter telling him that, well, telling Joab to basically get Uriah murdered. So he does exactly what he here condemns people for. He complains, as we saw in verse 8, that there's things which are vile, idolatry, all around him. Well, what did his wife do, Michal, when Saul sent men to kill him? Well, she put the household idols in the bed to look like a person, so it was a large life-size sort of idol that she had, and said, oh, that's David and he's sick. And they say, okay, so they don't kill him, they don't take him at that time. Well, wait a minute, David, you ended up involved with the very things that you condemn other people for. When you come to Romans chapter 3, in verses 10 to 14, Paul takes a whole load of David's psalms, and this is one of them, every man lies to his neighbour, and applies it to actually all of us, to everybody. And yes, that was a justified interpretation, because actually David himself did exactly what he accuses other people of doing. So the line that divides good from evil does not so much run through society, whereby there is this group of pristine, righteous people and this majority of evil people, as David and his immaturity and self-assuredness thinks at this stage. The line that divides good and evil runs right through the human heart, and it is there in every one of us. And David had to come to realize this. So Paul, under inspiration, I think corrects David and says, look, yeah, this may be so, that every man lies to his neighbour, speaks with flattering lips, has got a double heart, and that is all of us, and therefore we need salvation in Jesus by grace, and therefore in Romans 4 he goes on to quote the words of David about the blessedness of the man, that is David, to whom God imputes righteousness, not by works, not by obedience, not by righteousness, and says this applies to all of us. David, therefore, is every man. And so David becomes a representative of all of us, and I think we've all gone through this path of assuming maybe in our immaturity that this line that divides good from evil runs sort of through society, that we are this righteous remnant. And of course, there is such a thing as a righteous remnant, but the righteous remnant, as it was in the time of Elijah, is then interpreted and explained in the New Testament as being the remnant or the chosen ones according to grace, that they are only righteous by God's grace and by imputed righteousness. Once you grasp this, then you move away from this sort of primitive form of sort of denominationalism whereby we are right and our little community is perfect, and I and my friends who I know within the church, we're the righteous and we're surrounded by the wicked. That, of course, on one level is true. You know, you may be the only Christian in your whole town. You may be living in a small Islamic town in some place in the desert somewhere in a Middle Eastern area, and you know, you and your friends are the only believers in Jesus in the whole area. That may be so, but that does not mean that you are thereby pristinely righteous and the people around you all wicked. It's more complex and it's more profound and more beautiful than that, that you are the ones who believe and are counted righteous. You look at the parables of Jesus, so often they talk about two groups of people. The sinners and the sinners who realize they're sinners. The two sons, go and work in my vineyard. No, I'm not going. And then he repents and goes. And the other says, yes, sir, I'll go and work in your vineyard. And he doesn't go. The two sons, the one who goes off and spends his father's money and inheritance and comes back repentant, and the elder son who says, I did not do these things, I'm righteous, and who ends up at the end of the story outside of the father's presence, outside of the father's family by his own self-righteousness and choice. I never did anything wrong. Of course he did. And the wise and the foolish girls, they all run out of oil. The difference is that the wise realize that that's likely to happen. They realize their own frailty and they take oil with them, but they're all asleep when they ought to have been awake when the bridegroom came. And so you could go on. And so, as I say, the difference is not between the good and the bad, the righteous and the wicked. The difference is between the sinners who repent and throw themselves upon grace and the sinners who don't. That's the difference. Once you understand that, all arrogance associated with self-righteousness, all sort of hard barriers against the wicked, we cannot have this person in our ecclesia, in our fellowship, we have to disfellowship them, they have sinned, they have this or that or the other. And I think of the way that folks in the community that I was associated with were disfellowshipped if they divorced, if they married somebody who was not a believer, let alone if they divorced and remarried. And no, this is all a total failure to understand the real division that there is. It's not between the righteous and the wicked. It's between the sinners who don't repent and who are self-righteous and the sinners who cast themselves upon God's grace. Once you see that difference, you will find a greater humility in your own heart, in your own relationship with God, and in the way that you relate to others, particularly to other sinners.